It is Tuesday, June 4th. Welcome on into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Ooh, a lot to get to today, Cherry.
Yes,
let's lay out the show. So first, we're going to talk about the University of the Arts, which is closing on Friday. We learned this news last Friday. So with 1 week's notice, this more than 150-year-old institution, a tentpole arts institution in our region, one of the largest property holders in Center City, is shutting its doors. We're going to try to get answers.
Yeah.
From the Inquirer's Kristen Graham, who helped break this story. We also want to hear from you. Are you a member of the UArts community? Do you have questions that we can try to answer for you, or questions that you want reporters to dig into?
Yeah.
Studio2@whyy.org is the email address. 888-477-9499 is the number. We would really like to hear from you. That's going to be like the first half of our show today.
Yeah. And then for the second half, Bruce Springsteen,
the boss,
a.k.a. the boss, and his iconic Born in the USA album, which turns 40. The big 4-0.
Today.
Yes, that will be the subject
it's
of
discussion. It's a middle-aged album.
Yes, a middle-aged album. The crossover sensation turns 40, and so we're going to talk with an amazing music critic about his brand new book.
Yeah, all about Born in the USA, which is Bruce Springsteen's most popular album, maybe his most misunderstood album. And the way it has aged really tracks in many ways the way America has changed.
Yeah.
So we would love to hear your Bruce Springsteen thoughts, your thoughts about Born in the USA, whether the song or the album. Maybe you have, what's your favorite song from the album, perhaps?
And we're not going to judge, because I understand, you know, that Bruce fans have, there's levels to the fandom. So we just want to hear, just generally, we don't care what level you are, what's your favorite Bruce song?
Absolutely. Studio2@whyy.org. Bruce, of course, is from the great state of New Jersey. And let's start our news chat there today.
Yes. Voters in New Jersey are headed to the polls for the state's primary election day. This will be the very first time, Avi, that former President Donald Trump will appear on the ballot since his guilty verdict. The last Republican presidential primary contest, and it's one of the last primary contest for the Republicans of this year. Now, New Jersey Democrats and Republicans, they're choosing their Senate candidates. This is all amid Senator Bob Menendez's federal corruption trial in New York. So he's dealing with that. Menendez is running as an independent. He is not on the Democratic primary ballot, but Democratic voters are selecting from Andy Kim, Patricia Campos Medina, and Lawrence Ham. On the GOP side, Curtis Bashaw and Christine Serrano Glassner are among the contenders, with Glassner receiving an endorsement from former President Donald Trump. So those are, that'll be the race to watch today.
Yeah. And in some ways, maybe the biggest news is what happened yesterday when we learned that Bob Menendez, who we already knew was not running as a Democrat, is seemingly going to run as an independent. Now, he could always withdraw. I believe he has until August 16th to withdraw if he would like. And it's not exactly clear what he's doing or what his goal is here running as an independent. But that could really upend the general election, because he's been the senator since 2006 in New Jersey. He's got a lot of name recognition. If he draws votes away from whoever the Democratic nominee
is, that'll be a win for the GOP. So they're looking at this as a positive if Menendez has run as an independent. They're looking at this. This is an advantage for the GOP.
But which, of course, never wins these types of races.
Yeah, but we don't know what the outcome of this trial will be. So there's a lot that's going to be in the air.
And please tune in tomorrow. We're going to have analysis, election results, breakdowns from the Garden State. That's on tomorrow's program, Studio 2. And so stay tuned for all of that. Also, stay tuned on this story, which I'm not even sure how to describe this next story. Is it a story at all? We don't know, Cherry.
Still developing. Yes.
So the Free Library Foundation, which is connected to the Free Library of Philadelphia, has a very popular, long-running program called Author Events. You know about it, Cherry.
Yeah, I think you've been to quite a few,
Have you hosted?
I hosted one before.
You've hosted
Absolutely.
One? It's this flagship program for the library. Mm-hmm. They bring in all of these amazing authors and thinkers to do talks and interviews. And then, weirdly, like late afternoon yesterday, the Author Events people send out this note saying, it's canceled. The whole series is canceled. It's over.
The whole season,
It's over.
Mm-hmm.
Then shortly after that, the head of the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation, Monique Moore Pryor, says it's not canceled, but the entire staff has resigned, effective immediately. Okay, we're all very confused now, right, Cherry?
Yes.
You know, this author events thing is a huge part of Philly's cultural calendar. It's a strange development. It's a confusing development. Yes, I'll be honest, it feels a little fishy, or there's a lot of questions we don't know. I mean, there's a vacuum of information, and trust me, people online are trying to fill that vacuum with their own theories. But we don't know what's happening with this very popular author events program. People listening have probably been to these events. I've been to several. It's a great program, and we want to know what's going to happen to it.
Yeah, and just to, so you know, some of the names that have been at this event in recent times, Stacey Abrams, Kara Swisher, you know, Fareed Zakaria. I mean, big names.
That's just in the last couple months.
That's just in the past couple months. And the season, of course, was chock full of big events. And it has attracted a lot of big names. We get to interview folks for Studio 2 that are coming to the Free Library.
We do have some self-interest at play here. There's no doubt about that.
And so we hope that this works out. We'll see what happens. But it is definitely...
And we hope these employees have been treated fairly.
Yeah. I mean, for an entire staff to sort of...
That's weird.
That to protest resign or resign in protest, it definitely makes you say,
Yeah. And I would just say, like, when a lot of big time authors and thinkers come to Philadelphia, it's to participate in this specifically.
Yes.
I mean, it really is a big part, like I said earlier, of our cultural calendar here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, for sure. And so we're going to move on to our next story. Friends, speed cameras could be coming to Broad Street. If you'd like to just all those folks who've been just speeding up or down Broad, it may be.
Time's up.
Yeah. City Council just advanced a bill that would have cameras stretching the entire length of Broad Street from South Philly to the Montgomery County line. Now, we all know Broad Street is one of the busiest roads in Philadelphia. And Mayor Parker's deputy managing director, Mike Carroll, said Friday automated speed enforcement has been very successful in saving the lives of pedestrians and motorists on Roosevelt Boulevard. So they want to bring that over here. This would follow that pilot program that started in 2020 with 10 speed cameras on Roosevelt Boulevard. And it's been very successful over there. 90%
reduction in crashes. I mean, that's amazing.
So many, but, you know, hundreds of thousands of traffic violations have been issued. So people are getting banged with those fees. But they're hoping to save some lives along Broad Street.
Yes. Speed cameras on Broad Street will be quite a sea change. Certain hours, right, it's too crowded for people to speed.
Yeah.
But there's large stretches of like the evening, the night, the early morning where people can really get moving on Broad Street. And that can lead to crashes, can lead to fatalities. You mentioned this has been successful on Roosevelt Boulevard as a pilot program. And Broad Street's, by the way, not the only major thoroughfare in Philadelphia they are targeting with this. So we could see speed cameras all over Philly pretty darn soon.
And by the way, $150 fines that you would get in the mail, and they would base it, you know, on your license plate. So no escaping it.
All right, let's duck down to Delaware now. So Aubrey Plaza, who starred in Parks and Recreation, is a native Delawarean, is teaming up with another Delawarean, Dan Murphy, on a new cartoon series for Amazon Prime. And it's got an interesting premise. It's about a house cat named Kevin that's tired. you with me so far?
Okay.
Yeah,
go ahead.
It's a house cat named Kevin.
Uh-huh.
He's tired of you laugh because that's not a cat name.
Not a cat. Yeah. You know how I feel about human names on like domestic animals. But go ahead.
Shout out Jilly Rose Gregg. Kevin is tired of living with humans, and he sort of has a breakup with his humans, and what is Kevin's place in the world after all of this? It sounds lovely, I have to say. So Aubrey Plaza, Delawarean, Dan Murphy, Delawarean, they're going to write this thing and produce this thing. We actually have a clip of them talking about a children's book that they wrote together called The Legend of the Christmas Witch. And let's bring that in. A little Delaware pride for you.
We were in L.A. and New York when we get to the point where, like, and then she's in Delaware. Nobody really reacts.
They're like, where is that? Is that a state?
Is that a magical place?
So like, we're really, we're literally just, trying to put it on the map. And I think it's just, it's a special, it's our home.
It's our home, and it is a special place. It's the first state, and now it is the creative nexus of Kevin. So we're excited to see Kevin come to Amazon Prime, and what kind of adventures is Kevin going to get up to? Kevin, we don't know.
The fact that the cat is named Kevin means Kevin's wild. You know what I mean? Just Kevin's wild. I'll just put it out there because you know my theory about that. I also think it's a really cute idea because pets do get caught in the middle of breakups, man.
That's true.
And so, you know, Kevin's tapping out. He's like, you know what? I'm going on my own.
Yeah. And we actually had a show about cats. And cats, this is not...
And you're a cat person.
I'm a big cat
person. Full disclosure.
We had a whole show once about cats. And cats are remarkable in that they can live with humans, but they can really thrive without humans. Mm-hmm. They're one of the few species they can really just go back and forth like that. And so, you know, in a way, this is, you know, a reflection of a biological truth about cats.
And so
I went too deep there, maybe. I don't know.
But you know what? I like that about you, Avi. But you know what? I want to meet Kevin. This cat, I'm going to have to check out the show.
You can meet him on Amazon Prime.
I'm going to have to check out the show.
So now we want to return now to much more serious news.
Yeah, we're turning to the surprising news that the University of the Arts is closing on June 7th, just 3 days from now. Students and faculty, they were caught completely off guard when the news broke on Friday, most of them learning about it from the Philadelphia Inquirer, which broke the story, not the university.
It's just shocking. You know, the university simply has not been very transparent, except to say that it lost accreditation and is in financial trouble. That's really all we have so far. So we're going to talk about what caused this closing of a more than 150-year-old institution and also how students and faculty are coping with this news. And to start our conversation, we have a rising senior at the University of the Arts, Natalie DeFruscio, on the line. Natalie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for letting me speak about this.
Absolutely. Natalie, we know you're a rising senior. All of this is happening to you at a critical point in your academic career. Tell us how you found out and what was your initial reaction?
Yeah. So funny enough, I was at the Phillies game when one of my friends sent me the Inquirer article, and I had no clue what was going on because earlier that day, like at 2:47 hours before, I actually got an email to apply for graduation. So I filled all that out. And then hours later, I read through a news article that my building was shutting down or that my school was shutting down. So it was very, very shocking and surprising.
Wow.
Yeah. What were your first thoughts? I mean, your mind must be racing at this point.
Yeah, at first I thought maybe it was like a building or like a dorm or something, like not the whole school itself. But then like reading the article made it very clear that it was the entire university that was closing and I only had a week left.
Oh my gosh.
And so what sort of steps are you taking? Because next year is supposed to be your graduation year.
Yeah, so thankfully a bunch of schools have welcomed UART students with open arms. I applied to Moore College of Art and Design, as well as Temple's Art School Tyler. They said that they would honor credits and scholarships for all students. So that is amazing. And many, many other schools and art schools and performing schools have welcomed UART students for the next year.
Do you know what your decision is going to be? Would you like to stay at a school in Philadelphia?
Yeah, so I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm from, like, Delaware County, so I'm one of the lucky ones that I can commute. But, you know, I have friends. My roommate is from Boston. So, like, I have friends that from different states that need to figure out if they're going to stay in Philadelphia, if they're going to go home, you know, all that stuff.
I got to ask you, I mean, so many, I've met people who went to University of Arts. They loved the school. They loved their time there. What has it been like being a student at U of Arts? The community of faculty and the students, tell us about that.
The professors are absolutely amazing. I've had so many great experiences with professors. They are so helpful, and they really want to uplift students. You know, it's not an us versus, like, it's not like a student versus teacher mentality. They are on your side. And the students, obviously, are very, very helpful. Me and like my group of friends, like we do nothing but support each other. It's a very, very tight community. Everybody is willing to help each other, and it's a very like fun community. And you know, the professors and the students throughout the entire school have a great connection.
obviously, there are so many unanswered questions, and there was supposed to be this town hall yesterday. It got canceled, so those questions are lingering. If you could sit down with the board chair, with the president, what would be your main questions for them?
Gosh, I have so many. Yeah. But I would just ask, like, where did the money go, and why did it take so long to tell us?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, those are the two biggest questions that everybody has, because everybody's paying tuition, everybody's paying room and board, you know, all this other stuff. You know, within the last year, we got a new student lounge and we got a SAC fees in. Like, you know, there was no indication, at least to me, that we were in financial trouble. So where did
you even said up until that day, they're sending out these emails that are like business as usual type of emails.
Exactly. Like that day, I know a lot of people got billed for their tuition. And paid their tuition hours before they got told it was closed. Mm.
And so you look back and you have seen nothing. If you think back now, I'm sure you've been sort of peeling through memories over the past 3 years. Were there any indications that you could end up here?
I mean, hindsight's 2020. They did close one of the dorms one of the dorms closed in the past year. And then we got a new president within the last year. That's Carrie Walk now, but I didn't really pay much mind to it. I didn't think it was going to be anything this bad, but I definitely think, like, you know, those were probably some indications.
Yeah. Well, Natalie, thanks so much for your time. And obviously, we hope that your senior year, wherever it is a spectacular senior year.
Yes.
Because you absolutely deserve that after everything you've been through with this. Thanks again, Natalie.
Thank you so much.
That was Natalie DeFruscio, was supposed to be a rising senior. Yes. At the University of the Arts.
Stick with us. We'll have more on the University of Arts sudden closure. We'll be right back. This is Studio 2. Hang with us. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We're going to continue our discussion now about this stunning announcement that the University of the Arts will close on Friday, June 7th. As you just heard, students and faculty were completely blindsided by the news, which the Philadelphia Inquirer broke on Friday.
Yeah, and here to talk more about what's behind what seems like a sudden decision is Philadelphia Inquirer education reporter Kristen Graham, who has been covering the story. Kristen, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me. Always good to be here.
Yes, and listeners, of course, we want to hear from you. We also want to hear from students, faculty, University of Arts alumni. How are you feeling about this news? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
And I'll just start with a comment here from Julie, who says, it's heartbreaking and enraging. It's incredibly destabilizing for the city and arts in America in general. That's what Julie has to say. So, Kristen, there's a lot we don't know, but what has been the school's official explanation so far about why it's closing?
So we knew for the past couple of years that there are lots of small schools and art schools that are, you know, losing enrollment because of the pandemic, because of financial pressures, other things. But certainly the fact that all of a sudden the University of the Arts is closing in 1 week, shocked to everyone. So their official statement was unexpected financial crisis, you know, that cropped up. They had a weakening cash flow position. And so, you know, ultimately decided to do it. I think it caught so many people off guard because even elected officials said they found out on Friday night or found out, you know, shortly before when Middle States accreditation, you know, was pulled. And so it's not like, you know, the mayor knew, there was no one who was trying to work out a deal. It was just seems like it was the university, you know, really small group of folks at the university who said, you know, hey, we can't do this and we're going to have to close in a week.
Yeah, this stuff always leaks. It always leaks. No one knew about this. I mean, that's just so crazy.
Yeah. And I read that one trustee said $40 million. That's the amount that it would take. Can you talk about this $40 million? What do you all know?
Yeah. So, you know, all we know is that number. There was one trustee who said that she even she did not know what the unspecified financial crisis was, but that the number was $40 million. It would take $40 million to bail them out to keep going. But at this point, you know, accreditation has already been pulled. You know, students are enrolling elsewhere. And so it's just, you know, a mess with a ton more questions unanswered than answered.
Yeah, I'm going to read in a comment here from Hittard, who says they own, I'm talking about the University of Arts, they own a lot of real estate on Broad Street, and they sure do. Couldn't they sell some of it to stabilize their finances? I have so many friends in Philly who came here to attend U of Arts, and they stayed. This is going to be a huge loss to the city. Thanks for that comment. That's a great comment. You know, you just mentioned that the accreditation has already been pulled. So people who are hoping for a Hail Mary here, I mean, I know it's hard to say how realistic that is, but it does seem like some things have already happened that would make it very hard to come back.
Yeah, I mean, it would be, I mean, what's happened is already extraordinary. It would be even more extraordinary for that to happen because Middle States usually pulls accreditation. That is a slow process if that happens. And in this case, it was the university saying, hey, we're going to cease to operate on June 7th. And Middle States, you know, within a couple of days pulled accreditation, which is unprecedented.
Yeah. Unprecedented.
Rhonda comments, it's a big blow to the city and the history of the institution. I'm even more unhappy about the sudden announcement. I wonder if another art education institution could be put there. And I got to ask you this question about the communication. There was supposed to be a town hall. It didn't happen. Is there any explanation for the lack of communication to the students, to the faculty, and to the general public?
So really no explanation for the way this was communicated. So many people found out about the closure itself, including, you know, folks who attend the university, folks who work at the university through our story on Friday. And then, you know, as you said, there was this town hall. 10 minutes before the town hall was supposed to happen, it was canceled by the university. They said, you know, we just don't have enough information to answer your questions. You know, here, ask your questions on a Google Doc and we'll try to get back to you. There's a group of students who are staging a sit-in at the university, and they 20 of them slept there overnight, and they said, we're not leaving until we get answers. I talked to one student just before I came here who said, you know, we have heard nothing from leadership, and the only, you know, direction we've gotten is from the community. You know, professors on their own reaching out to students out of a sense of, you know, obligation to them, even though they're coping with, you know, enormous loss themselves.
Yeah. If you want to email us, studio2@whyy.org, we are talking about the sudden closure of the University of the Arts here in Philadelphia. Building off what you just said, Kristen, Rafi says, places go out of business all the time, but I feel if any institution or entity is collecting tuition or deposits for future service, they should have a greater responsibility to notify in advance. So based on that comment from Rafi, there have been some stuff. There's been some stuff floating around about lawsuits or potential legal action or what type of recourse could people have. What do we know about that at this point, whether that's recourse for the faculty or the students or other people in the community?
So, I mean, certainly, you know, people are just kind of throwing ideas around at this point, right? Without direction from the higher ups, you know, other than we're going to try to help you enroll in other places if you're a student. What we do know is it seems like there's a class action lawsuit brewing, and that would just be for faculty and staff because federal law says if there's a mass layoff, you have to give 60 days notice. And that was not given. People got a week's notice. And so, you know, some people have said they've already expressed interest to a law firm that's reached out to say, yeah, I'll join this class action lawsuit. But that would just be to get, you know, the money back, right? Like that wouldn't be, oh, we're going to keep University of the Arts open. So I don't know of any recourse from, you know, for students, for families, anything like that.
Aaliyah comments, completely unprofessional. They knew they were closing this semester. They should have notified the students at a minimum at the beginning of fall semester so students can make arrangements to transfer elsewhere. I want to talk about the student body. What are the options that are before the students? What are they trying to do? We heard from Natalie just a moment ago. You probably heard that. She's a rising senior.
Right, definitely. The one good thing is that a number of institutions have stepped up and said, we're going to offer seamless transfers. So Temple, Drexel, Rowan, Moore College of the Arts. You know, I've heard from the College of New Jersey. Schools that have similar programs have said, hey, come here. We'll let you transfer all your credits. And we will do our best to match your financial aid so you won't be paying more than you would have been paying at the University of the Arts. But of course, you know, University of the Arts had a number of programs that were very specialized. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, you know, you're a psychology major at one university, you go to another university, and that transfers pretty seamlessly. If it's a very specialized major, obviously it's going to take some, you know, some doing to be able to get the same kind of degree and take the same kind of studies.
We have a caller on the line. This is Nash, who wants to ask about the accreditation or has a comment about the accreditation. We're coming toward the end of the segment, Nash, but briefly, what is your question or comment? You're on Studio 2.
I feel like I read that there were reasons across the board on why they were going to lose accreditation, and it wasn't just this particular issue. I was just wondering if she could elaborate on what that might be, if she knows.
Yeah, what has Middle States said? Because they did seem to suggest they were out of compliance in several areas. I mean, what do we know?
Right, right. So, Middle States basically took that step, but they didn't take the step until the university reported to them, hey, we're going to close immediately.
Okay.
And so it could be that there were some things that were, you know, out of compliance, but, you know, Middle States isn't going to pull your accreditation immediately. We'll work with you. Hey, you need to fix this. But once University of the Arts said, we are going to, you know, we're going to go out of business in a week, they just said, you know, you're finished now. And so summer session had been underway and those classes have been stopped.
And we have about a minute left. So I got to ask you, I mean, if we zoom out, is this part of something larger than just University of Arts? Because we saw Cabrini close, Delaware College of Art and Design, PAFA.
So definitely
what's going on?
Yeah, this is a period in higher ed. There are demographic shifts. There are far fewer students enrolling in college. And also, you know, the pandemic was tough on universities. And so it's a situation where if you're a large university, you can weather that storm. You got a big endowment, and smaller universities are, you know, some of them are going to need to merge or end. But obviously, we saw with Cabrini, they gave folks a year's notice. Mm-hmm. Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts and ending its degree programs also gave folks a year's notice. So for University of the Arts to end so quickly is just really unprecedented.
And as we let you go, I want to read one more comment from Bernie, who says, I'm saddened, especially because this is the home of the Lightbox Film Center with its spectacular old movie theater. This is not just about the University of the Arts as an educational institution. It's also a pillar of the arts community here in Philadelphia. We do have to leave it there. Kristen Graham from The Inquirer helped break this story. Education reporter, thanks so much for your time, Kristen.
Thank you.
And Bruce Springsteen, coming up, we are celebrating his iconic album Born in the USA. It turns 40 today. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
All right. It's the summer of 1984, a June day just like today, and you hear the first track on Bruce Springsteen's new album. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The record is Born in the USA. Released 40 years ago today, it put the boss at the top of the charts with song after song, easily cracking the top 10. The powerful song and distinct melody of the title track catapulted him to a new level of success in the pop world, but quickly enter the political arena.
You know, Born in the USA became something of a patriotic anthem, and a new book celebrates this music while taking a look at the mainstream politics and identity that became so closely tied to it. Stephen Hyden is our guest today. He is a cultural critic at UpRocks and the author of a brand new book called There Was Nothing You Could Do, Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA and the End of the Heartland. Steve Hyden, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, please share your memories of this album. What are your thoughts on the politics and culture? What's the best song? What's your favorite song? Call 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
And I wanted to start the conversation actually with the cover art of your book, Stephen. It's got Bruce in this skimpy white t-shirt, blue jeans, guitar, American flag in the background. That's the Bruce Springsteen from this album. And for a lot of people who aren't big time Bruce fans, like, that's the Bruce Springsteen mm-hmm. they conjure up when they first think of him. And yet, you know, he's in his mid-30s when he releases this album. So I think to start the conversation, it might be helpful to remind people, you know, who was Bruce Springsteen before he was the blue jean wearing, blue collar singing, you know, talking yeah. about tiny little towns. You know, who was he before Born in the USA?
Well, he was one of the most acclaimed singer-songwriters working in rock music in the 70s into the early 80s. He had released 6 records leading up to Born in the USA. And in the book, I really write about not just the record, but also his career before the record came out and the career after, because I do think you can look at his early records and there's a slow build to the phenomenon that finally exploded in the mid-80s. And it's not a straight line. You know, Bruce Springsteen, I think, was ultimately someone who wanted to have an impact on culture in a big way, which is what he had with Born in the USA. But I think there was also some fear of that, fear of the loss of control, fear of being misunderstood. And those fears ended up to be well-founded for Bruce Springsteen, because he had to deal with the downside of success as well as, you know, all of the, you know, sold-out tours and top 10 singles and all the great parts of being a rock star.
Yeah, and I want to play an excerpt from Renegades, Born in the USA. It's a podcast featuring Bruce Springsteen, and former President Barack Obama. And here is episode 3, where they're talking about images of masculinity, and Springsteen talks about his own image. Take a listen.
I was at my most popular, I feel, when I had an image that was least like myself, you know.
So you think you can take us, huh?
I had a very alpha male image.
So you think you're tough out here in California, huh?
So right in the middle of the Reagan era 80s.
The boss.
Right? And that view of the United States as something powerful and domineering was resurgent.
And I want to talk about that comment, because Born in the USA, Avi kind of set it up with the image, the iconic image. And Bruce Springsteen says there that that was not him at all. Can you talk about the album, what it did for him as an icon, and how folks sort of viewed him when this album first came out?
Yeah, I mean, I think what he's talking about there is something I write a lot in the book, where, you know, when Bruce Springsteen first came on the scene, he was the scrawny, scruffy looking guy. And in his personal life, he was essentially a loner. You know, he liked to read books. He didn't really hang out with people. He was prone to depression. You know, he wasn't necessarily like this sort of macho all-American person that you would have guessed that he was if you looked at the videos from Born in the USA or the album cover. But, you know, there was a physical transformation that happened with him in the early 80s, where he started working out. He got much more muscular. He became, I think, a more kind of conventional sex symbol, which, by the way, it's not like he was, this was happening to him without his consent. I mean, this was something that he put out there. He was the one that went on stage with like sleeveless shirts and, you know, exactly. He's looking really handsome. but I think it did put him in a weird place, where if you look at how he was being written about in 1984, 85, there was a common thing that op-ed writers would do with him, where they would compare him to Sylvester Stallone, you know, because Sylvester Stallone was at his peak as a movie star at that time, making the Rocky movies, making Rambo, these very rah-rah, almost jingoistic type action movies that were really big in the mid-80s. You know, and there was a Chicago Tribune editorial, for instance, that called the Rambo of rock.
Wow.
And if you know anything about Bruce Springsteen and you're looking at the lyrics to his songs, that's clearly like the last thing he wants to be known as.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to be known as this, you know, sort of guy going back to Vietnam to rescue POWs and bring them back in this sort of simple-minded action movie kind of way, the way Sylvester Stallone was doing in the Rambo movie. He was writing very thoughtfully about Vietnam veterans and how they were mistreated by society and how we need to pay attention to these people, very much in line with him, speaking up for the underclass, speaking up for the little guy. So again, I think it comes back to this loss of control that always happens when you become that successful. You lose control over how people perceive you, how they talk about your art. You have people that are maybe liking your art for the wrong reasons or reasons you didn't intend. And clearly that was something that Springsteen was dealing with at this time. And I think it's affected how he looks at that album, quite frankly. Because he's always expressed mixed feelings about Born in the USA.
Yeah, some like, ambivalence for sure.
Right. Like the album that came out before it, Nebraska, a much different record that came out of the same period when he was writing all these songs. He's much, I think, more comfortable talking about that record and loving that record because people know what that record is. You know, there's no really misunderstanding with Nebraska. People know, okay, these are stark acoustic songs about outsiders. But there's still people who hear songs on Born in the USA and they don't get them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, is it part of the confusion, though, Stephen, the fact that the songs themselves musically have a strong beat and a rhythm? They kind of sound happy, but if you listen to what they're talking about, they are often very sad. And I think this is the perfect place to bring in Dancing in the Dark. We have an excerpt here from perhaps the most popular track from this album, at least some people would argue. Let's hear a little bit of Dancing in the Dark. I check my look in the mirror. And this guy hates himself, right? I mean, he wants change his clothes and his hair and his face. And yet you listen to the song and you obviously want to get up and dance. So what was Springsteen trying to accomplish, Stephen, by marrying these happy sounding songs with these really downbeat themes?
Yeah, I mean, this is not a songwriting approach that's unique to Bruce Springsteen. A lot of people have done this, but he is one of the masters of it. Where, like you said, you take this music that is so ingratiating, like you hear the song and you want to hear it again, and then you look at the words and it's so sad. And you mentioned Dancing in the Dark being the song about self-hatred. You have a song like Glory Days, for instance, that a lot of people, when they hear that song, they think, oh, this is just a straightforward song about how life used to be great when you were young. And it's actually a song about how nostalgia is a trap, how it's empty, and how at some point you're going to be an old person who's just reminiscing about these stories that no one cares about.
Just sitting at the bar kind of talking to yourself almost by the end of it.
Right. I mean, I happen to think that that makes these songs richer.
Yeah.
You know, that there is like a multidimensional quality to them. I mean, the title track is the most obvious example of this, where people hear that song, they hear the chorus. It's such a grab you by the throat type chorus. I mean, you want to pump your fist and shout along with that Born in the USA every time you hear it. And then you listen to the verses and it's about this disaffected Vietnam veteran who's been rejected by the world and it feels very alienated, but he's not rejecting America. He's reminding you that I am a part of this country too, and you can't forget me. You know, I am claiming my citizenship. But yeah, that's a song that was, you know, it was appropriated by the Reagan campaign in 84, which I think was done so knowingly and cynically by them. But then you still have just millions of people who are just innocently misreading that song. It reminds me of a song like This Land Is Your Land, you know, the Woody Guthrie song, where people hear that song and they think, oh, it's just like a nice campfire sing-along. And they forget the later verses that are a little more pointed about America. That's a tradition that goes back a ways. But, you know, I think about myself, like I heard this album when I was 6 years old. Like this is a record like Thriller by Michael Jackson, where everyone heard these records if you were alive at the time, even like a little kid like me. And I don't think I would know what K-Song is without Born in the USA.
Yeah.
You know,
Vietnam.
I needed the Trojan horse of the music to get to me. So like, that's, I think, the positive side of that, because it exposes these ideas and themes to people that
to
might
not a broader audience, yeah.
Right, right.
Absolutely.
And since you were talking about Glory Days, we're going to play a little clip of that. Go right ahead. Before I... And I mean, and for the overarching message to be that nostalgia is a trap and we're bopping into this.
It's a heck of a Trojan horse, for sure.
Yeah. I want to ask you, because you talk about this in your book, Stephen, that, you know, Bruce speaks to men with his music, expressing a, quote, deep-seated, tortuous, inarticulate, and intractable masculine pain. And you say this is a power that Bruce Springsteen has. It's almost like a therapy session. Can you talk about this power that he had to sort of summarize and express, you know, the angst and just sort of like the feelings of so many men, many of whom never shared those types of feelings?
Yeah, and just to be clear, I think Bruce Springsteen speaks to like all kinds of people.
Not
just men. And look, and some of the most knowledgeable Bruce Springsteen fans I know in my life are women. So, you know, I just want to be clear on that. But I did want to write specifically about, in that section you're talking about, mm-hmm. where I think he is writing a lot in his songs about guys who can't express themselves. And in the lyrics, they're trying to come to terms with who they are. Oftentimes they're trying to come to terms like with their fathers. I mean, that's a big theme in his songs. And I think that's something that, for the men in his audience, it'd be something that they relate to. They see themselves, I think, in the characters of these songs. And what Bruce Springsteen does is he offers catharsis to those people musically. So, you know, you can go to a Bruce Springsteen concert and you can cry when he plays the or he plays, Independence Day or any number of like the great tearjerkers of Bruce Springsteen's career. Another thing, too, that I write about in the book that I think Bruce Springsteen is really good at, and this gets to another sort of idea of masculinity, is his best love songs are about other men. Like he writes a lot of songs, romantic songs, about male friendship. And an example of that is Bobby Jean on Born in the USA, which is a song that by now everyone is aware that he's writing about Steven Van Zandt.
Who's a member of the band, yeah.
Member of the band who exited the band during the making of the record. And a lot of people hear that song and they think Bruce is singing to a woman. And you could certainly hear the song that way if you want. But he's really singing to this man that he loves. And he's not, you know, putting it in like coded language to conceal that. It is open love for his friend. Yeah. And he's wishing him well, and he's sad that he has to go, but he wants him to be happy and free in the world. I mean, there's so many great Bruce Springsteen songs like that. Like Backstreets is a song like that. Yeah. There's an outtake from Born in the USA called This Hard Land, which is like that. And again, like just for me as a kid hearing that, I think that was a positive role model.
Yeah.
That like, yeah, you can love your friends and you can be honest about that and open about that. Like that sort of emotional release valve, I think, that Springsteen's music has for a lot of people actually makes it valuable. I mean, I make a joke about this in the book, but I think it's probably true that, you know, listening to Bruce Springsteen or going to a show might relieve like your ulcer or less your chance of heart disease or something.
It's palliative. It's real.
Because I think there's a lot of people who maybe they can't express that normally, but when they connect with this music, it allows them to let that stuff go.
Yeah, let's do a little healing right now. Actually, I'd love to play Bobby Jean for folks who don't remember. This is a great track. Let's hear a little bit of Bobby Jean from Born in the USA.
We like the same music. We like the same bands. We like the same clothes. Yeah, we told each other that we were the wildest
That's Bobby Jean, really about Steven Van Zandt, who's a member of the E Street Band. And we've getting some comments here, people talking about their Bruce memories. Garden says, I was so jealous of Courtney Cox getting pulled up on stage in the music video for Dancing in the Dark. I begged my mom to let me get my hair cut just like hers. It didn't work out so well for me. Yeah, by the way, a very young Courtney Cox is in that music video, if you didn't know. Winston says their favorite song from the album is I'm Going Down. When I was on a trail crew working on fixing the Appalachian Trail, the senior trail crew leaders would blast that song at 5 a.m. Every time Bruce said down, we had to do a push-up. And I think he says down about 70 times in that song. I'm surprised now Winston has a positive memory of it. But I wanted to – you mentioned earlier, Stephen, that the Reagan campaign ends up using Born in the USA and kind of twisting its meaning, you say cynically. But one thing you write about in the book is that you know, Born in the USA comes out in 84. It's an election year, right? And Springsteen, even though this album is really a repudiation of Reaganism in many ways, does not endorse Walter Mondale, who was Reagan's opponent that year. And he sort of just stays above the fray. But since then, Springsteen has been much more explicitly political. We heard him on that podcast with Barack Obama. He's supported many, many Democrats openly. I mean, is that a sign of Bruce changing, or is that a sign of the times changing, that kind of flip?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I think with Springsteen, you know, he obviously has become much more explicit in where he's coming from. I think there was a belief that if you listen to my songs, you'll know where I stand. And the Born in the USA experience proved that that wasn't true, because there are people, whether you're on the left or the right, you can look at Bruce Springsteen almost like a Rorschach test, and you can take from him what you want and apply it to your own ideology. And there were people on the right who did that, who looked at him as like a traditional male archetype, you know, talking about hard work and values, and he believes in the American way, and then they disregard the rest. And at some point, that wasn't good enough for Bruce. And he did start coming out and endorsing candidates, and he played the Vote for Change tour in 2004 and all that. But we live in a world now where I think people expect that more.
Yeah,
I don't know
if that was, exactly.
Like in 84, I don't know if people were expecting. I mean, there were certainly activist musicians back then, but I don't know. It's different now. Like, we expect famous people to give endorsements, like they're a newspaper editorial board or something. I think that also speaks to just how the culture has changed.
And real quick follow-up on that, in terms of not letting it be a Rorschach test anymore, you mentioned this performance that Springsteen does of Born in the USA in our region, Upper Darby, right outside of Philly, in December of 95. You know, he's about to play Born in the USA, and he says something really remarkable. What does he say, and what do you make of those comments?
Yeah, this was a recording that he puts out a lot of live recordings via the live Bruce Springsteen website, and this was a performance. And I don't have the book in front of me, so I don't remember the exact words, but he basically says, you know, if you're a Republican, you probably got the wrong idea about this song.
He calls out Republicans for misinterpreting the song and sort of, and then I think he says something like, but there's probably no Republicans in the audience, which is fascinating, right? Because he was supposed to be this great unifier back in 84.
And we know a lot of Republicans love Bruce Springsteen, you know, starting with Chris Christie, you know, the former governor of New Jersey, the most famous, you know, which I always think it's fascinating to know that your hero probably doesn't like you, you know, like can you imagine, like, you have this hero and you're like, oh, they probably don't like me back. But so that's what, that's interesting about that comment, that he would say that, because I think there probably definitely were Republicans in the room. But I mean, I think, you know, there's this thing with Bruce Springsteen that, you know, we know where he comes from politically, but he also has always been this centrist type person. And, you know, he's been more explicit in terms of his beliefs, he's also like not backed away from that idea. And there was that Jeep ad that he did that ran during the Super Bowl. I think it only ran once, actually, but it was in 2021, and it was literally called The Middle. And it was Bruce, he's in Kansas at a church, which is like in the geographic center of the country. And he's saying that the middle is this sacred ground in America, and all are welcome, and we need to come together. And that's an idea that I think is up for grabs right now. And feels like a lot of people don't necessarily believe in that anymore.
Yeah,
so
it's an interesting touch point for sure. And it's a great book. And thank you so much. I wish we had more time, but we don't. That is UpRock's cultural critic, Stephen Hyden. His new book is There Was Nothing You Could Do, Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA and the End of the Heartland. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Stephen. And we have a bit of breaking news. University of Arts President Kerry Walk has resigned. Walk had been president of the institution for less than 1 year.
Yeah, and that's it for Studio 2 today. But obviously much more to come on that story in the coming days.